Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we get to talk with Dr. George Wolf about health literacy. He's the founding director of Family Practice Residency Program at Moses Cone Memorial Hospital in Greensboro and has done a lot of work in this area.
I'm really passionate about understanding better how we can do a better job of helping all of our patients and ourselves communicate better to make information more accessible. Probably using words not like accessible.
Right. Simple words that everyone
simple
can
words.
Understand.
Simple words can understand.
Well, let's talk first about some research that matters, and we'll do the best job we can of sharing this research in plain words.
That sounds great, Christy. We have our very first research that matters is about losing weight with people who have mental illness, things like schizophrenia and depression and bipolar disorder, which is a lot of people, and how best they might be able to lose weight.
Yeah, this was a study that looked at 291 people who were randomized into two different groups, one that got the intervention and one that didn't. And the people in the group were about 58% had schizophrenia, 22% had bipolar, and 12% had major depression. So people with real mental illness who were all in the trial randomized to get help with losing weight.
Right. And they were all overweight, obese to start with. The average weight was 225 pounds. And they followed them for almost up to 2 years. And they found that those who got this intervention, which was an app, a health app that you could download and use on your phone on a daily basis, lost significantly more weight than those who got recommended to use a food diary and just record how much you're eating, or an exercise diary, how much you're exercising.
Well, and it really does highlight that targeting, if this is our most high or one high risk population of people, that targeting interventions for weight loss that are specific to people's behaviors and are accessible and easy for them to use can really make a difference. It did in this case.
Well, and the name of this particular app is called My Meal Mate. And I thought, oh, this is wonderful. It must come somewhere from the United States, but it does not. It comes from actually Great Britain, but it's free. So I think all of our listeners out there, Christy, they might like to look at My Meal Mate, and they can go look at this from the British Health Service and download it and maybe use it to help them figure out how to best lose weight.
Well, let's do our next research that matters about policies in some hospitals and other places to not hire smokers.
This is a New England Journal of Medicine article, as was the one about the health apps that we just talked about. And this particular article looks at the ethics and the pros and the cons, or as my daughter would say, the pros cons, the pros cons of whether or not we should or should not support policies that eliminate smokers from consideration of being hired. Like many hospitals, like the Cleveland Clinic, major hospital systems saying, if you're a smoker, we will not hire you.
Well, we know that this is true at UNC hospitals and many places, that allowing smoking on hospital property or campus property has become something, a strategy that many places have used and have actually really cut down on the number of people who not just smoke on the property, but motivates people to quit. And so we can see on a big level how some of these things, though controversial, make positive steps towards helping people quit smoking.
And in this particular case, they take that one step further.
Exactly.
And the argument is, well, maybe the policies we have in place aren't strong enough, and so we have to go to the next level of the policy, which is not hiring those who continue to smoke. And there is one argument that I find persuasive for this policy, Christy. I'll see what you think, which is the third hand smoke, the smoke that is on the clothes of the smoker who comes into the environment, and we know that that residue actually does have an adverse impact on health of our patients and coworkers. So I think that is an issue.
Well, I also think we talked a couple weeks ago, Adam, about, you know, what doctors themselves do for screening impacts, how they deliver the message to patients, and whether or not patients then follow those routine screening advice. And I'm sure that that is somehow also linked with whether or not a medical provider smokes and how they're caring for patients and recommending quitting smoking to patients. So in a hospital setting, I feel like it adds other layers than even just in a regular workplace.
And on the other side, though, we do understand this is an addiction. We understand that it's very hard. So I'm really cautious about going down that pathway myself personally, Christy, because I think we have all kinds of addictions, eating addictions and smoking and alcohol. And I think it's very, very problematic when we start excluding people from work. I think we should do everything to help them quit and have all kinds of policies. I'm probably not in favor of this, but that's just me.
No, I don't think it's just you. I think you're going to have a lot of people behind you on that one. Let's talk about alternative therapies for high blood pressure. This is really common that people are looking for, and many times taking, herbal or alternative medicines like acupuncture or other things to reduce their blood pressure.
This study was in the journal Hypertension. I think that's an appropriate name of this journal because it was about 1,000 studies where they were looking at data about all different types of alternative ways of lowering your blood pressure, ranging from what's called isometric hand grip exercises. I guess those wrist kind of bars that you squeeze and squeeze and squeeze, compared to just, you know, weightlifting, compared to acupuncture and other ways like meditation.
And what they found is that all three types of alternative therapies did reduce blood pressure some. Certain ones were more effective. So those isometric hand grip exercises were able to lower the blood pressure by 10% after 4 weeks of doing the exercise, in doing those hand grip exercises. But regular walking programs didn't make as much of a difference.
Yeah, I don't know how I felt about the study, Christy, or the, you know, because those isometric hand grip exercises, have you ever used those?
My daughter started putting this little thing in her pocket to squeeze when she's feeling angry. And I wonder, not for high blood pressure, she's 7, but still, I know what we're talking about.
Yeah, I've used them. And I think they're good for getting rid of anger, but all of a sudden you have this rash of carpal tunnel syndrome, these wrists that get inflamed and your wrist gets real sore. So I'm like, how does that really reduce blood pressure? I'm not so certain. And they poo-pooed a little bit walking exercises, which have great benefits for overall health. What's the bottom line here, you think?
I think the bottom line is if you have high blood pressure, you should work with your doctor to get it down. And that may involve some of these very natural exercises and things that can help, but also might require some medication.
Speaking of natural, let's go to our very last research that matters, which is about vitamin D. And everyone, our listeners, have heard Christy and I talk about vitamin D. And this was an article in the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology Journal. That's a mouthful.
Yeah.
And they compared, though, taking different ways of getting vitamin D, whether it's a vitamin D supplement of what's called D2 or D3, or getting your vitamin D through mushroom powder.
So we know you can get vitamin D through your diet. And this really looked specifically at these mushrooms containing vitamin D2 and found that, at least in this study, if you took it once a day for 12 weeks during the winter, that the mushroom powder could be just as effective as increasing and maintaining vitamin D levels as taking supplemental vitamin D.
And that got me thinking, Christy, well, how much vitamin D do you get from eating mushrooms in general? Because they are a source of vitamin D, according to this. But it turns out that a single mushroom has about 3 to 4 units of vitamin D. And if you need about 1,000 a week in a supplement, that's a lot of mushrooms.
1,000 a day.
Got all these mushroom powder. But there are good sources, natural sources, in your diet of vitamin D. And that's what I like about this study. And it turns out that in addition to cod liver oil, which is the natural history of how rickets in part got solved in one of the cures with people taking cod liver oil along with sunlight, but this fish is a great source of vitamin D. I did not know this.
It is, and certain fish like tuna and salmon have more vitamin D than others, and they're good for you for lots of different reasons. And, you know, 15 minutes of sunlight. We don't want to encourage people going out and sunbathing because of skin cancer, but sunlight gives you vitamin D.
Having your salmon while you're having a short
picnic.
Sunbreak. Well, that'll conclude our research that matters. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. George Wolf about health literacy. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with the founding director of the Family Practice Residency Program at Moses Cone Memorial Hospital in Greensboro, Dr. George Wolf, about health literacy.
We're glad to have you with us, Dr. Wolf.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You know, you've had a long career as a teacher of doctors and a teacher of patients. How did health literacy become the thing that really caught your eye at this phase of your career in life?
Basically, it came with the teaching, because I had a good deal of patients that would come and say I didn't understand some of what was told. But mostly, when I would refer someone for a consultation, most times they would come back and say, I didn't understand it more than he said.
Well, that sounds a pretty straightforward. I think we could all understand that kind of concept. Mm-hmm. When we say health literacy, what does that actually mean? Because the word itself is a complex word, three-syllable word, literacy. What do we actually mean, though?
You can be literate and not health literate, but it was formed by the Healthy People 2010 in Washington in the health department up there, and they came up with the following: the degree in which individuals have the capacity to obtain, process, and understand basic health information and services needed to make appropriate health decisions. And the problem with that is that it's written in a grade higher than the average American reads.
Mm-hmm. So considering that, how would our listeners or how would an average person know if they have good health literacy or not?
Well, there's several things that go into it. Number one, you have rights as a patient, and you have responsibilities as a patient. And the biggest responsibility, in my opinion, is that you need to be an active, informed part of the health system. And this is what I've tried to teach the patients and the folks that I had in practice. And when they would come back from a consultation and not understand what the specialist had said to him, I tell him, then you need to just hold up a hand to him and say, whoa, I don't understand what you're saying. And some have done that. I had one lady who asked me when I was teaching a course called Partners in Health how to get the doctor's attention when he was headed for the door. And I said, you get between him and the door. And the next week she came back and said, I did it. And I got him. And he said, who the heck told you that? And I said, Dr. Wolf. He said, he was one of my teachers. But she said he sat down and answered every question I had.
I'm not sure you want to give away all the secrets here, get all the doctors in trouble here. But one of the things I've discovered is that as a doctor, I like to talk to my patients. I like to tell them. And at the end of this long explanation, which I'm sure I do perfectly, I ask the patient, is there anything else that you would like me to say about this? And the answer uniformly is, can you please just write that down for me?
Mm-hmm.
Is health literacy, it's more than just talking and hearing, mm-hmm. right?
It is talking, skill of talking, the skill of listening, the skill of analyzing and then the ability to put it all together into the health system and get what you need.
So how do we, I mean, I'm sure we're going to come back to lots of talking and things, but when you're just, it just occurs to me, when you're writing, so you write instructions, there must be ways that we should be communicating in our writing. We are communicating lab results, x-ray results, all kinds of appointment reminders. Are we using the wrong language a lot of times in those types of communication?
Well, most of the health education material given to patients are written in the 10th grade level. And the study done by the group in Washington, they did 20,000 people they studied and divided health literacy into four areas. But they found in this that at least 30% of the patients that they interviewed and asked about did not understand the words, that we use a lot of big words that they didn't understand, and they were embarrassed to ask. And I've tried to tell them, then bring a friend, both of you have paper and pencil, and you both try to take notes of what the doctor is saying, but both of you hold up your hands and ask questions. And very often they come back and tell me, I've done this and it did help.
I love that you're so much of this, because it is a relationship and a partnership between the doctor and the patient. There are certain things that doctors need to do differently to deliver things in a way that's appropriate for the patient. But you are really focused on activating that patient to raise their hand and do active things like get in the way and bring a friend. What else should doctors be doing? Maybe we can ping pong back to assess and sort of get a better sense of where patients are coming from and how to figure out what is their health literacy.
Well, what I've tried to tell a lot of them is that they need to ask questions and not be embarrassed by what they don't know, because a lot of the language that we use and get so accustomed to seems like ordinary words to us, to physicians, but it is not. And what we try to do is to have the doctor say to him after he's finished explaining, now tell me what I said.
The teach back.
And if we can get them to get the patient to speak back to them and tell them back again what they heard, that is a big help.
I was just thinking as you were saying that about one of the things we frequently tell patients about a cause of a disease, and we say it's idiopathic, and which really is the simple language for we don't know. Why we would use the word idiopathic to describe something we don't know. And I wonder how many times we do this routinely because we're taught the medical language, we're not taught the health literacy. So are you teaching health literacy? Are we doing a better job of teaching that to our students and our residents and the practicing physicians?
Well, I haven't been teaching with the residents in the last 5 years, so I'm hoping that they still are improving. But we did try our best to tell them that. Try to use small words, simple words. Words that you know are not purely medical, but are words that are heard here and there. And then if they ask, do you understand what that is? And sometimes they're going to get a yes and sometimes a no.
Are there certain tips that you recommend for patients to do before they come to the doctor to try to improve their understanding?
One of the best things that I've tried to tell them, and several patients have told me that they agreed that it was very good, the day before a visit to the doctor, I tell them all to take paper and pen and write down, why are they going to the doctor the next day? What is the purpose of the visit? And number two, what questions do I have about this visit? Write them down. And also, you need to write down all the medications that you're taking and give that to the doctor so he's aware of everything you're on. Then that helps a lot.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with our guest, Dr. George Wolf, the founding director of the Family Practice Residency Program at Moses Cone Memorial Hospital in Greensboro, about health literacy. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with the founding director of the Family Practice Residency Program at Moses Cone Memorial Hospital in Greensboro, Dr. George Wolf, about health literacy. And Dr. Wolf, before the break, you shared with us a lot about how patients could prepare for their visit and get the most out of understanding from a visit with the doctor, and how important it is for patients to know they have rights and responsibilities related to their medical care. What's an example of a right that patients have that they should know about?
The patients have both a right and a responsibility, and both are equally important. The right includes understanding what the doctor is telling you and being able to make sense out of it personally. And that means understand the doctor's instructions, and the right you have to accept what the doctor proposes for you to do or reject it, or you may even ask for a second opinion. You have that right to say, doctor, this sounds too complicated for me. Can we have another consultation with another doctor and let me see what I can learn? Also, you have the right to know when a doctor proposes a lab work or an x-ray, ask him why. What's he hoping to learn? And when will you get the reports? So often they don't get the report, but they have the right to get the lab work reports and interpreted for them. You know, that needs to be done. Also, they have the right to designate someone to speak for them if they are unable to speak for themselves. And this is part of the living will, and this is the health power of attorney. But it's most important. All of us should have that.
Dr. Wolf, you know, listening to you, in some respects, it reminds me of a president of the United States when they become an ex-president. They say things that are like, wow, when you were president, were you saying it like this? And I'm wondering, for you, being retired from the clinical practice of medicine, did something change, or were you always really this patient-focused? Because I think this is the type of physicians that Christy and I would love to be. We would like to see our learners be like this, but it's harder in reality. Mm-hmm. Were you always like this?
I think so.
What led you in that path? Because I think that's something we would like to capture and bottle and sell.
I'm not sure how it came about, but I've had a number of patients tell me that they felt I had a personal interest in them, that I didn't rush them, and I didn't try to run out the door and close it behind me, but gave them the opportunity to ask questions. And I still run into people that were my patients out at the grocery store or somewhere that tell me they still have not found another doctor who will be as patient with them or as interested in them as I seem to have been.
So today, though, in our health environment, where we have so many other things that are happening in there, and the federal government has requirements, and we're having to do patient education, actually as part of what we do, and give printed materials, is it easier to do that now with all the health reform and all the changes, or do you think it's more difficult?
I think it is definitely more difficult. My nurse told me when we retired that I was picking the right time because she could never keep me on time, that I always overdid the office time. And I think that this is happening today. The health program that we've got pays more for the technical stuff than it does for a doctor to spend the time with the patient, get to know the patient, and understand what's wrong and where it's coming from.
Hear, hear. I know you've done a lot of work with outreach, it sounds like, with nurses, with patients and churches. Tell us the story of, you know, when did you wake up one day and say, you know, this is really what I'm going to do with this time that I have?
That's a good question. The thing I did one time at a request of a friend was to give a talk. And I liked doing it, and the patients, the people there seemed to like it. And so it sort of grew from that. And that I did more and more. I got involved with the congregational nurses, and they arranged meetings for me to go to with churches I didn't even know were in Guilford County. And it's been so interesting to meet people from all over the county. And I've had a number of them that I've seen at one place or another that said that their information they got was very helpful. So that has made me feel like this is worthwhile.
So what advice do you have for helping doctors and patients overcome barriers that could be related to culture? It could be related to education. It could be related to all kinds of things where we come from very different backgrounds. You've mentioned questions that patients can do. How can a patient recognize the doctor who really maybe is trying, even if they're not succeeding fully?
I think most doctors are trying, and I think it's a matter of getting to know each other. And this is one thing that so many specialists don't do. They're more interested in the medical part than the person part. And I think we need to be just the opposite. We need to get to know the individual. We need to know his family life, his business, and, you know, really get to know where he's coming from.
So an appointment just to get to know one another, even necessary before one tackles all of the questions about health.
Well, if a patient will give the doctor that list, including the list of questions they would like about, talk about at another time, this very often leads the doctor to arrange an appointment just for those questions.
So the doctor might not be able to talk about them all today, but
that's correct.
To know that that's a priority and let's make another appointment. You also had some recommendations of, so you have the before the visit, what the patient should do, asking questions during the visit, and how about at the end of the visit? What should patients sort of reflect on before they let that doctor walk out the door?
The main thing is that before they leave the room, they should ask the doctor, what is my main problem and what can I do about it? And what is, I don't follow these instructions and don't do the things you want me to do, what'll happen? And those three questions should be asked every time by the patient before leaving that exam room.
You're here, and particularly even about medications, because I think we know from surveys that half the time when we recommend medications, people go to the pharmacy and they don't get filled, or they get filled and never taken.
This is true. What I try to tell the folks is when you get a new prescription, when you go to pick it up, say, I need to talk to the druggist. And you have the druggist take time to talk with you about what this medicine is. Important thing with that is be sure that the druggist knows that if you're allergic to anything, but also what's the diagnosis. It's, some medicines are used for two or three different things today, but taken differently. But if they will talk to the druggist, that is much safer and better.
Well, that is good advice. So often we just sort of check that I decline that counseling when that counseling really could be another important piece of understanding what's going on with your medical care. Well, Dr. Wolf, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us, for making this effort to teach patients, nurses, churches, and people of our listeners in the community about how to get more and understand more about what's going on with their health care. Thank you for taking this time.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Christy, we have some questions today about, we've talked about it before, but a different way of Clostridium difficile in someone who's older.
About headaches and waking up with them.
About, can you actually eat solid foods if you've actually got a feeding tube in?
And about risks of having a premature baby if you were premature.
Well, that goes from one end of the spectrum of the age to the other. Let's listen to our very first question.
My grandmother is 94 years old and has had C. diff twice. I've heard that it can be caused by other environmental factors or even by medications. Since she has had it more than once and was in two different living arrangements, one was at a rehabilitation facility and one was at her assisted living residence, is it probable that her medication caused the infection?
What do you think, Christy? This is a very interesting question.
It is, and it's a complicated question, too, because that bacteria C. diff, you are more likely to have that if you're hospitalized or if you're in a facility where it can be passed around, and certainly if she'd had an antibiotic. There are other things that can put you at high risk as well, including just advanced age.
Well, and once you've had it, mm-hmm. then it's like all doors are opened, you know, opening loose, because getting rid of it is not so easy because recurrences are pretty frequent. So we may treat it and we may get rid of it, but it may come right back, and resistance to some of the antibiotics we're using mm-hmm. is a problem.
It is. I mean, this is a complicated question. I mean, the good thing is that in most cases, there are medicines. We do have antibiotics that will treat it and make it better. We certainly hope that your grandmother doesn't get it again.
And work with your doctor to make sure that it is gone, and check to make sure that it is gone. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to our very next house call.
Occasionally, I wake up with a headache. I was told once that if you wake up with a headache, something is seriously wrong, since sleep acts like a reset button for the body. Is this true?
I relate to this, Christy. Have you ever woken up with a headache?
Yes, I have, many times.
Yeah.
And it's such a bummer because you think you're going to go to sleep and then, you know, you want to start your day fresh. But if you wake up with that headache, it really does start you out on a sour note.
Well, and I don't get really bad migraines, but sometimes I wake up with a headache and I think, oh, it'll go away. And then like later in the day, it's not gone away. And like, oh, I probably should have taken something for that earlier mm-hmm. than now. But what about this really bad headache? If you wake up with a really bad headache and you've never really had headaches, what do you think? Is that something we worry about?
Sure. I think if you woke up and you had a sudden headache that felt like the worst headache of your life, or if you also had numbness or tingling or weakness or other problems, then for sure that would be a lot more concerning than someone who has headaches and occasionally you happen to wake up with one.
One of the problems is a lot of times people kind of sleep in positions where maybe their neck doesn't relax so much mm-hmm. and maybe they have arthritis in their neck or they have all this tension.
Or I chomp my teeth at night.
Grind
and sometimes
your teeth.
I think my grinding teeth causes the headache.
Christy and I want to know if someone can help us out there.
Sorry,
we want to get rid of our morning headaches.
Our problems.
But most people, it's really not something serious, but it should be addressed because you really don't want to wake up. You don't want to start your day with a headache.
No.
So
talk with your doctor and to try to identify what triggers the headaches and what kinds of things might help you prevent them.
Let's listen to our very next house call.
Is it safe for someone with a feeding tube to be eating solid foods? Isn't there a possibility of the foods going into the lungs?
The question I would have is, why does a person have the feeding tube to begin with? So if the feeding tube is placed because of trouble swallowing, where you can't swallow without the risk of it going into the lungs, if that's the reason for the feeding tube, then it's not a good idea at all to be taking also food by the mouth.
Yeah, exactly, Christy. And most of the time, that would be the reason, because the person is getting food going into the lungs there, though sometimes it might be placed for a couple weeks after someone maybe had a stroke and they're regaining the ability to eat. And in that case, well, sure, but we're going to do that under an observation with a trained professional who can watch you as you swallow to make sure that you're not choking right afterwards so that it's safe to actually then perhaps pull the feeding tube and let you eat.
Right. So it's not an absolute that you can't have any food if you have a feeding tube, that you can't take any food by the mouth if it's done with doctor or a trained professional's guidance.
And even occasionally, someone who has cancer who maybe has a feeding tube placed in perhaps while they're undergoing some treatment for the cancer and they can't eat a lot, regains the ability to eat some, and you don't want to pull the feeding tube. So there are certain circumstances, most of the time not. Thank you for that very good question, and let's listen to our very last house call.
My husband and I were both born 2 months premature. I can't help but think that our baby will be born prematurely as well. Does the fact that both parents were born prematurely have anything to do with whether or not the baby will come early?
No, my heart goes out to you, the fear of the unknown, of not knowing if that necessarily puts your baby at risk if you're pregnant now. I had to look this up because there are lots of things that put people at risk for having premature babies. It turns out that there is a modest increased risk for having a preterm baby if the mom herself was premature, that there is some link. It's not very fully understood. And
what about the father?
The father, actually, no. That there isn't any connection.
We can't blame the father on this.
The women always blame ourselves.
Hallelujah.
Anyway.
We're not going to blame the male
no
this
fair.
One.
No fair. But
we're not going to blame the female either, by the way. We're not going to blame parents here.
That's right.
I mean, this
you
is a statistically increased risk. But the reality is the great majority, if you are probably practicing safe behaviors in terms of not smoking, not mm-hmm. drinking, those kinds of things, good prenatal care, you will not have a premature baby.
I do think it's a good idea to bring this up with your doctor to make sure that you're getting everything, that you're doing everything like avoiding substances and getting your urine culture and certain things done to help lower your risk of premature delivery. And then if you do have one, we've got the advances in medical care from the time you were born till now have been tremendous in this area.
Were you directing that at me, Christy, from the time I was born?
Maybe. It's a long time ago.
It's very true. Well, thank you for your questions and all your questions today. And we want to thank you, our listeners, for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you and your health. And you can share your own questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
And we want to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. George Wolf. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. On 97.9 FM, WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.
If it's happening in our Chapel Hill Carborough community, you will hear about it on 97.9 FM, WCHL, and you'll find it on our website, chapelboro.com.
Are you looking for new customers? Try Our Local Deal, brought to you by WCHL and the Chapel Hill Carborough Chamber of Commerce. You offer a deal to the community from your business, and folks purchase it. Everybody loves a deal. With Our Local Deal, your company or organization is featured on 97.9 FM WCHL, on the site at ourlocaldeal.com, and through social media. Want to try the best marketing deal in town? Visit ourlocaldeal.com or call us at 919-933-4165.
2 years ago, we launched chapelboro.com so that our community could have its first digital town square. Since then, our town has evolved and chapelboro.com is evolving with it.
Chapelboro 2.0 carries the same great features and now provides an even better user experience. With its sleek new design and wide accessibility, Chapelboro 2.0 truly is
bigger, faster, and stronger.
We encourage you to stop by multiple times a day. We guarantee there'll always be something new to see.
Chapelboro 2.0, bigger, faster, stronger. Check it out now.